Blog Talk Radio.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. A thousand people in the street singing songs and they're carrying signs. Mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. Your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop now, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.
Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the first conference call for the Committees of Safety. Tonight's show is going to be a little bit different than our regular shows. This show, hopefully, will be a highly interactive question and answer session about the Committees of Safety, dealing with your questions, where your questions are at, where your confusion is at, whatever they happen to be. There is a ton of information we've been posting lately. And it's going to raise some questions out there, and we really cannot begin to address, you know, where your concerns are at until we know what your specific questions are. Everybody out there is going to have different questions, so I hope to have this be a very interactive session. Now, there are three ways that you can get involved. You can type your questions into the chat room at www.ufchatarmy.com. You can call in. The call-in number is 646-716-4518. You can also get on Skype and get on that way. In order to do that, you need to add me to your Skype contact if you don't already. I will bring you in. I can bring you into the call then, and we'll get you set up on the Skype group for this call. So again, you can ask your questions on the chat, you can call them in, or you can get on Skype and voice them in as well, save you a buck. So, with that being said, I've got Gary Hunt here with me. Also on the phone, we've got Don DeHaven, governor candidate for Pennsylvania, who's openly calling for the Committees of Safety. He's on the phone with us right now as well, in fact. So, welcome to you gentlemen, and welcome to everybody else that's in the chat room right
now. Well, thank you.
All right, Gary, so we've been talking about committees now for, you've been talking about committees now for over 20 years. We've been working on the committees for about a year, hit and miss here and there.
Well, it was 17 years, 1993 after Waco.
17 years to be exact then. So, you know, we're really starting to see a lot of activity out there now. We've got Ohio, which is actively promoting them and getting them set up in every county possible. We've got Pennsylvania. We've got Texas. There's states that are all over the place setting them up. Some states more aggressively than others. But they're being worked on in many states at once. So this is a good thing, I believe. The time has come.
So before the show, too, Don and I were talking before the program started, and the question rose about the grand juries, and as I pointed out, I'm going to post a link to the end of the revolution, beginning of independence, and in there, I've only included one instance where a court was set up, where it was clearly set up, but militia and courts cannot be self-proclaimed. They cannot just say, we're the militia or we're a court. They are created under the Constitution and the state constitutions by the authority granted through the Constitution to establish courts and the militia. So they're addressed in the state constitution or statutes. So they have to have the same authority, civil authority, to create them. Now, a committee of safety in western Massachusetts before Lexington and Concord had actually they were shutting down the king's courts. They were forcing the judges to resign. And I included one instance in that article where they created a court. Now, during the course of the Revolutionary War, those courts only dealt with criminal matters. They suspended all civil matters until the war was over with. They didn't feel it was necessary to try and deal with a breach of contract or foreclosure or indebtedness or anything during the course of the revolution, because those were some of the elements that led to the disenchantment and the change in the nature of the king's influence on the government. So, yes, the committees of safety historically in our own history, the history of the United States of America, not the colonies before the United States, but the United States of America, courts and militia, their civil obedience was to the civil authority, the Committee of Safety, or by whatever name it might have gone by. So the authority of the people, when it's lost from the existing government, in that case the royal government, because the royal government was not abiding by the English Constitution or the charters that created the colonies, the allegiance of the courts and of the militia transferred to the committees of safety. So there I've answered the question I almost got answered before the show started, and that's the authority that we're looking for. Hopefully never have to use it. Hopefully that if we form committees of safety and demonstrate that the people can organize and put out the call to reclaim our government under the Constitution, it won't go beyond that. Now, the question is, will it work or not? The only way that we will find out is if we create committees of safety and establish them throughout the states and begin through them to, one, organize the militia, two, authorize grand juries, because grand juries used to be pointed in both directions, at the people and at the government, that you could go to a grand jury foreman or a member of the grand jury and have a complaint against a government employee or agent or elected official and file that. Well, the government has kind of stolen the authority, so the state attorney or the U.S. attorney now is in charge of the grand jury, and he filters what goes to the grand jury. So in the 230 years, we've seen the grand jury virtually stolen from the people. It has become an arm of the government to go after people.
It has become an arm of the whatever political party happens to be in control at the point. And a lot of times we're not even seeing actual law being upheld. You're seeing witch hunts being used by whatever party happens to be in power.
That's true, but it's through the authority of government they do that. They have to replace the existing state
attorney
or get the state or U.S. attorney to go along with them. And when Bill Clinton took office, he got rid of all the state U.S. attorneys, or almost all of them, and replace them with women. I'm not sure what his motivation was in that. We can only speculate, but then they were the ones that brought the charges against the Branch Davidians. Well, no charges were brought against the small army that came, jumped out of their vans or their cattle trailers and started shooting at a church. None of them were ever even charged. Ron Hirushi, Randy Weaver, an Idaho grand jury, under the state attorney, took the case of the possibility of murder on the part of Ron Hirushi, who shot Vicki Weaver. He was indicted by the state grand jury. The federal government then stepped in, the Department of Justice stepped in and said, well, that's a federal matter. They said it's a federal claim now, and so they transferred it to federal authority. And then they pretty much said, well, there's no crime here, and so they dropped the charges that were brought by the indictment by the Idaho grand jury.
So, look, can I ask a question here? If you have a committee of safety all throughout, let's say that this would have happened in Pennsylvania, and we'd have these committees of safety throughout Pennsylvania. If you would have had a situation like that, and the state attorney general would have filed criminal charges against this federal law enforcement figure, at that point, if the federal government tried to steal this case away like they did with that, would the, as, I'm asking this because I really don't know the answer. If I'm the governor, I believe I have the authority anyway to step in and say, no, this is a state matter. You have no jurisdiction to rip that out from underneath us. This is a state matter. But the committees of safety should have that authority. Am I correct?
Ultimately, the committee of safety would. Understand that laws are enforced. The last five letters, force. That's what the government uses to enforce the law.
Right.
If a state was willing to stand against the federal government, but understand how many physical ties there are between the federal government and all law enforcement within the state, the state troopers,
right,
the county sheriffs, the local police departments receive federal money, and in doing so, they agree to recognize the Department of Justice as the source of all authority. So you would have to break the ties. Now, everybody's talking about these 10th Amendment resolutions. Back in the 90s, I think there were 27 states enacted 10th Amendment-type resolutions saying that we're not going to do this anymore. But they're just resolutions. They're not law. And they could not do without the money. Now, with the physical problems that states have now, financially, they're strapped. They're dependent on that federal money. So if you were governor, you would have to recognize that by standing firmly on the authority of Pennsylvania to conduct a trial in that manner, that you would probably lose all federal funding, and you'd have to supplement that by alternative methods.
Well, considering the fact that the federal government is borrowing all this money and it's broke anyways, I'm not so sure that that would probably even be as big an issue as it used to be, because they're just not able to hand out the money like they used to.
So let's look at where this Committee of Safety would come in.
Right.
In essence, that's what happened in Western Massachusetts, that the court, the Massachusetts Government Act, which was passed the same time as the Massachusetts Bay embargo, replaced all the government officials in throughout Massachusetts, except for the selectmen and the town meeting, replaced all of them. All the court judges now came under, out of the charter that Massachusetts was created under, and came under the authority of the Crown. So the courts were controlled by the judges appointed by the Crown, which is all new to Massachusetts at the time, but basically what we just talked about, grand juries, where they're under the control of the government, and when I say royal government, just think federal government today, they're
right,
the same thing. So the committees of safety, with threat of force to enforce what they felt was right, told the judges to resign and replace those courts. So when you break that tie, if you've got committees of safety, they became the lawful authority. And if a governor or a sitting assembly, some of the governors sided with the colonists and some did not side with the colonists. The ones that sided with the colonists, for the most part, kept their prestige and their presumption of authority, at least to the extent that these new congresses or provincial committees of safety allowed it, but there were modifications to the authority that was granted by the Crown. So that people in government can transition to our side if they show that they're on our side. But the committees of safety became the enforcement tool now. Now, remember, there were no police departments then. There were no large county sheriffs. A sheriff might have one deputy. And so the aspect of law enforcement was completely different. If you go to outpost-of-freedom.com, you'll see a link to the library. I just finished reading an article fairly recently, written 2001. The title of it is actually a law treatise, is Are Cops Constitutional? And it compares what we have now to what we had then. And the idea that we have law enforcement in massive numbers, millions of law enforcement officers in this country now, is in exact opposition to what the Founding Fathers were looking for at the time. That this would be conceived as the standing army that Patrick Henry warned us about when he said there will be a British soldier in every house. We have come to that. Now, if that law enforcement comes with the governor in your case, then we have the means of enforcement. If the law enforcement is split or disbanded or is not up to the task, then the committees of safety, if they're called by the governor, can direct their militias to support the governor's actions in bringing this guy to trial. But then you, by that enforcement, you create the potential for conflict.
I understand that philosophy there. That's definitely something that has to weigh heavy on anyone who considers what's going on today. But if I'm understanding correctly, though, with the committees of safety in operation, in, let's say, in Pennsylvania, I'm governor, I'm supporting these committees, I'm mandating that our legislature abide by what these committees are delegating, say, what their delegates are delegating to the legislature to do, this increases their credibility, their power, because now we have a situation where the people are being followed. With a will, as long as their will is according to the Constitution, legislature must follow the will. Am I correct in that?
That's the presumption of our form of government, that the will of the people will be carried out through their representatives. However, as you and I discussed before the show, the political parties have taken over. The political parties influence the Democrats and the Republicans to fall in line with the party ticket. If you were governor, initially, you would have, under your Pennsylvania Constitution, you would have the state legislature. But if you recognize the committees of safety as a citizens' advisory council to both the governor and to the legislative branch of government,
right,
and said, look, this is the will of the people. Now, you've created a situation where the legislature has to make a decision to recognize the will of the people through the committees of safety as directed by the governor, or to ignore the governor and the will of the people. Now, that creates a breach. And that breach of contract becomes the consequence that results in Revolutionary War 230 years ago.
Right. Well, that's my purpose and my goal as being governor of Pennsylvania is I have to see these committees established. I would absolutely see these committees established, and the governor's office would be putting its full authority and weight behind these committees, because I see these committees as absolutely necessary to retaking the sovereignty back of our Commonwealth here. I mean, I can't imagine why any any person who is a patriot at all who wants to abide by the Constitution would not see the validity in this.
Well, I think that those that have the sense of the Constitution and the concept of government that we have, self-government they call it, that it means that we're not led by aristocrats. But what we've come to now is we've got two aristocratic parties, Democrats and Republicans, that are not much different than the courts of the king in England, where you had the Whigs and the Tories, but for the most part they were in line with each other, which is why even the Whigs could not get the Parliament to be reasonable in their dealings with this colony. I mean, the breach comes, and it comes in, you know, ways that might not be expected, but the Declaration makes it very clear that when the government no longer serves the will of the people and becomes tyrannical or despotic, that is the right, it is the duty of the people to cast off that government and create a new one.
Right.
And even if we use the same document, the Constitution, but perhaps add some amendments that provide greater safeguards, that we're totally consistent with everything our history represents.
So that answers my question, because I'm looking at credibility. I mean, I'm looking at the candidates right now from Pennsylvania who are running for governor. I see no substantive anything coming out of them. They're basically mouthing the same old lines of yesteryear. And you know, I'm hearing a lot of people say, "But what are you going to do? What can you do for Pennsylvania?" And that's been my whole crux of why I'm running, is the people have got to have the authority. They have to take back their authority. There has to be constitutional principles established, and the legislature, the governor's office, the courts, law enforcement, they must adhere to the Constitution. And this is where the committees of safety come in. When I first heard of this from Randy Mack, I was like, wow, this is something. I started reading and studying. I was like, this is absolutely what has to happen.
Well, when I first began reading about committees of safety after Waco, I was looking for how the founding fathers, you know, at the time, after what I saw happen in Waco, something had to happen. I was fully expecting a revolution to start. The militias were forming all over the country. Everybody was pissed off and dissatisfied with government. But I started looking for how this thing was accomplished. And since that time, I've acquired a number of other resources regarding committees of safety. But as I put the picture together and realized how powerful that was, I was wondering why I never learned about it in school. Now, I can understand that the government would be afraid of that aspect of how we were created, but then as I looked into it, I realized that the concept of committee of safety, even though it has been reduced in importance even more recently, was left out of the early history. In 1825, they didn't talk very much about committees of safety. And understanding that after World War II, the soldiers that came home didn't want to talk more about World War II. They wanted to get a job, buy a house, and raise a family. So when the soldiers come out of the war, they're done with it. You know, it's over with. Okay, it's time to get on with life. And so there was a disregard for the history of the Revolutionary period, probably until it appeared, best I can tell, until John Adams and Thomas Jefferson died on July 4th, 1825. It was sometime after that people started saying, well, you know, we've got a whole history there, and we've just lost two of the great of that history. We need to start writing down this history of the Revolutionary period. And so they began. So what they started doing was looking at children in school learning the history. Those are the ones that had to be taught, because we've lived through it for the most part. So they started looking at heroes and dates, heroes and dates, heroes and dates. So a lot of elements were left out in those early histories. Occasionally they'll touch on them, but the research you've got to do to find out about them is a lot more involved than what they were writing in history. Now, as Randy has found out, Encyclopedia Britannica and an international encyclopedia have both omitted the committees of safety from the record. So this has continued. Now that we understand where we came from and how we got there and how we had really the only smooth transition of government pre-revolution to post-revolution in the history of the world, we've got the elements. They were the elements that made people that were under the enforcement of the greatest military force that existed in the world at that time. They were able to muster a revolutionary war against them, to refuse to go by their edicts, to build an army, to take command and defeat the British at their own game and create this great country. They were instrumental. Without the committees of safety, it wouldn't have happened. It just couldn't have. So the necessity and the amount of involvement of the committee is predicated on the resistance to the will of the people, which is exactly what happened back then, as the government resisted the will of the people. For example, in Virginia, committees of safety sent the militia to, I think it was Richmond, but Patrick Henry led a group down there to seize the powder and ball from the storehouse. Now, the powder and ball was bought by the local community in case they ever needed it, and the governor tried to keep it, so he secured it. And under threat from Patrick Henry and his militia, the governor, I'm not sure if they released the ball and powder or returned the money equivalent value. I don't recall right now. But that was one of the first effects of a committee going under the authority of a committee of safety, saying, government, listen, that's ours. You can't take it from us. And then you've got other instances. There was a raid on a fort long before Lexington and Concord along the coast in, I don't recall what state, but a militia went up there. In fact, Paul Revere was among them, and they went up and grabbed the ball and shot from there. And there are a number of instances where cannon and other things that were secured by the government were taken back by the militia under the authority of the committee. One of them was kind of interesting because two bronze cannon were stored in a barn, and the British had posted soldiers at each end of the barn to guard these two cannon. And so the militia came in and took the boards off the side of the barn, snuck in, got the cannon out, and got them away. And the British didn't find out until the next day that somebody got snuck in and stole the cannon from under their noses. So this is where the militias transferred their obedience from the government, from the existing, de facto government, to the de jure government, by right government, the Committee of Safety, and the Committee of Safety directed them then to start taking action in preparation for the possibility of open conflict with Britain long before the war began.
Right.
Hey, do you mind if I jump in here real quick? I wanted to clarify something real quick, if you wouldn't mind. You know, when we talk about the committees of safety, we have to look back to the original founding fathers and how they set them up and how they operated. Now, when we look back, we find that they were a grassroots organization, meaning that they resided, that their power came from the local town, the local village. They would then gather in committee, in the county committees, and then form state committees, and then a national committee. But they were always a bottom-up organization. It rolled from the bottom up. Our founding fathers, when they were at the Continental Congresses, or the Constitutional, the Continental Congresses, they took orders from the states. Now, somebody posted a website asking if this was the website, committeesofsafety.org. Now, if we look at that website and their structure, we find that there is one person at the top who dictates everything to everybody down. That's centralization again. That's not how they were. That's not how they worked.
That would be a political party called the Committees of Safety, where you've got the hierarchy and the party saying, this is our platform, follow us. So, no, that is not the correct Committee of Safety URL.
Right, no. You know, when you look at that committeeofsafety.org site, you find that basically what they've done is they've centralized the entire thing. made the national organization the boss, and all of the other committees underneath better toe the line. Just like a political organization, like you said, Gary.
That web page takes one book written by Agnes Hunt, no relation to me, called Provincial Committees of Safety. Now, the entire book is posted at committee.org if you want to read it. I think I've got two states that I haven't posted yet, but the introductory chapters, the tables, everything is posted at committee.org. Now, she wrote a book about the Provincial Committees of Safety. Where did they come from? They didn't exist. There was no such thing as the Provincial Committee of Safety, but there were committees of safety on plantations, in towns, in villages, in cities, in counties. And eventually, they created a state organization. If you go to committee.org on the front page, you'll see a flyer that went out on April 12, 1775, exactly a week before Lexington Concord. And at that point, they called themselves the Provincial Congress. Now, when Agnes Hunt talks about them, she refers to that as the Massachusetts Provincial Committee of Safety. And what I keep saying about the name, they didn't always go by the name Committee of Safety, but it was when the lesser committees created that state entity because there were enough within a state, and South Carolina and Massachusetts, I think, were the first to actually create a state equivalent of a committee of safety. But they were, as Randy said, created from the bottom up. They didn't add at a federal level and said, you need to form your state committees, and after you get your state committees, you need to form county committees. That's a political party. That's the problem we have now. If you think back to political parties, when George Washington abhorred the idea of political parties, there were two parties in this country, most commonly referred to as Federalists and Anti-Federalists.
Right.
Federalists believed in strong central government. Anti-Federalists believed in a weak central government. We don't have anything like the Anti-Federalists today. We have two parties. They're factions of the Federalist Party. They believe in strong central government. In fact, we have three parties. One's called CommitteeOfSafety.org that believe in strong central government. And screw the people. We'll tell you what you want to believe is what the political parties do. And
well, look at the games they're playing even during election year. They've got the Republican Party, for example, has already basically lost some of their bigwigs to, I'm thinking Murkowski up in Alaska. She lost in the primary to Bill Johnson or Ben Johnson, Nelson, or I can't think of his name. And so she's now going to run as an independent, but the Senate just met in session on Friday, closed session, and her committee, she's sitting on the Energy and Environmental Committee, and they decided to go ahead and protect her committee seat for her until after the election, figuring that if they do that, they give her credibility, she'll probably get voted back in, even as an independent. So the Republican Party is playing their game, and the Democrats are doing the same thing. And where the committees of safety is different, if I'm following you correctly, it has nothing to do with politics. It has everything to do with just following the Constitution and making decisions at the local level that follow both the state, or in our case, the Commonwealth's Constitution, as well as in keeping with the U.S. Constitution. It has nothing to do with party politics at all.
Right. What happened back then is there was no party. You had the Committee of Safety, and they took their best that were willing to serve, sent them to the state level, who took their best who were willing to serve, and sent them to Philadelphia. So the people were known locally. Now, the news told more about what was happening in the colonies than we get today. Now we found out that the judge released Lindsay Lohan early, and now she's back in jail again. That's big news. We don't understand what's happening politically in our neighborhoods. You know, it's all gone from the news. Fortunately, the Internet provides a substitute and a means of communication. But it is that bottom up from the grassroots, truly
right.
Grassroots, and that's what the The entire concept of this country was based on pushing people up rather than dangling, I prefer to call them turds, dangling turds in front of the people and say, here, you have a choice of this turd or that turd. You get a turd no matter which one you pick. Health care, 1992 or 93, the Republicans were pushing health care. Oh, it's different than the Democratic health care, which passed recently. But they were both pushing health care. The first bailout bill came from the Republicans. Second one came from the Democrats. And they both accused the other of being bad guys.
Yeah.
That's how they spend the money. But they believe in a strong federal government that can impose health care on us. Mandatory. And if it's not mandatory, it will be. There's nothing that the government starts with if they don't continue on becoming more despotic in the application of any law, income tax, anything. It just gets worse and worse. And until we get that grassroots, the will of the people, and a little constraint on government, both state and federal, we're going down the same path that we've been going down since, probably since the Civil War, though we can see other stages, 1913, 1933, different times in our history where there was a big boost to this despotic path that they're on. So, yes, the committees of safety are the answer if they are instituted, if the people believe that we are self-governed in this country and that our self-government is not grasping at turds that are dangled in front of us called politicians, but instead they are people that we know and trust, and we compare them with people that another committee of safety know and trust. We compare them with another one, and we start pushing the better ones up. Dream until they're finally in control of government. We don't have self-government in this country.
No, we don't. No, that's the tragic part of this whole thing. We don't have self-government. I have listed that on my website for governor, that this country is supposed to be about self-governing. The power rests with the people. When it goes from there and diminishes as it goes up into the federal level. But the most power is always to be with the people. That's why we're given inalienable rights. They came from God, not from government. They came directly from God to man, not from government to man. And people have lost that understanding. And this excites me about committees of safety. Is as governor of Pennsylvania, I would love to start instituting these and protecting these under the office of governor in Pennsylvania. It just, to me, the absolute necessity that we have to have these all across this country if we're going to see this country stay a republic and not become just another division of the United Nations.
Well, yeah, if we get away from becoming a division of the United Nations.
I mean, you look at the president's speech on the 23rd to the UN. I mean, the man wants to hand us over to the United Nations now.
Oh, isn't he already? Hasn't he already taken Arizona to international court?
Yeah, and it's just amazing what's going on, and we couldn't get these committees of safety running fast enough, as far as I'm concerned.
No, I can find nowhere in the Constitution where the federal government can try a state in a foreign court, a court that doesn't even belong to any other governmental organization, just a club, if you will. What authority do they have over Arizona? I have yet to find that in the Constitution.
The problem I have in Arizona, and I don't know Janet Brewer that well, is I don't, and Gary's probably right, it probably has more to do with federal fundings and other things. They're more worried about that than they are really standing by the Constitution. But if that were happening in Pennsylvania and I was governor, I would absolutely say, we're not even going to honor this. We're not even going to answer this because it is not constitutional. And how can you honor something that's not even constitutional? How can you even answer something? How can you even send a lawyer to answer something that's not even constitutional? Because by every basis of that constitution, what they're doing is meaningless. It has nothing. Yeah, do you understand what I'm saying?
Oh, I do, yes, because Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution guarantees every state a Republican form of government, and if that Republican form of government has any authority at all to enforce the laws of the United States, the Constitution makes the Constitution and the laws of the United States the two supreme laws of the land, and then
right.
treaties and other things. Now, if that's the supreme law of the land, and the state cannot, the state it has to enforce federal law. Waco, they deputized the state police, the Texas Rangers, the McLennan County Sheriff's Department, the Waco Police Department. Now, if they can force the local entities to enforce federal law, why can't the local entities voluntarily enforce federal law? And we had the program on SB 1070. We had two programs on the show, and we went over the bill, and I compared that to what the federal law said, and nothing that they were doing, except for a miswording on one of the phrases in SB 1070, was inconsistent with federal law. In fact, federal law was set up with a database for local law enforcement to call and identify people as illegal or not. So everything was in place, and all they're doing is enforcing federal law, and they get sued by the federal government. Now, when is the outrage of the people going to be sufficient to cause the change? And how is that change going to come about are the two questions.
Well, I think we're getting close to seeing that. I don't know. It's definitely not going to be out of everybody. But we've got a large segment of the population that is upset at both parties, upset at the whole situation that's going on. So I think if there's any chance at all, any time at all, that's right to start these committees of safety to get people like me elected governor, and it is now, because we have to do something to reverse this tyranny. We're gonna wake up one day and find the handcuffs are already on us, and it'll be too late.
Well, I'm awake, and I see the handcuffs, but yes, that more people need to realize, and that's what the whole Tuesday program is about. There was a question asked about going to Arizona as militia, and probably warrants an answer. April 19, 1775, militias came from all over Massachusetts, Vermont, New York, and New Jersey, and Connecticut to Boston to aid those people that had just chased the British back to Boston. They were all sent by committees of safety, but understand, committees of safety were in existence at the time in most of those communities. The militia could not exist without some authority. Now, the government, the state government or the colonial government, did not provide weapons, did not provide a storehouse. The people bought the powder and ball. They stored it, the same stuff that the British were trying to seize at Concord. The committees of safety or the town meeting, which in most cases evolved into a committee of safety type operation, were the ones that sent the people to Boston. They crossed state lines. That question's, can they? There wasn't a request sent out. Just word went out, you know, there's a battle with the British, and so the committees would send their people down. That's not really dissimilar to what's happening in Arizona right now. So the militias going down there are responding the same way they did then. The element that the government has removed by textbooks and other means is the fact that, and the lack of acknowledgement by governors and county commissions of acknowledging committees of safety. And in talking with people, a number of militia have contacted city, county, or state and said, we're a militia, we're here, we're available if you need us, and they get no response back. So does that mean the militia can't exist? No, it can't, because the militia can exist because it's inherent in both the Constitution and the statutes of almost every state, if not every state, and federal statutes. The militia is described as all people or all males, certain age group, subject to exemptions. So can we not be denied that right of collective self-preservation because we don't have a government authority that's willing to recognize us? Well, Governor Dunmore in Virginia surely did not authorize Patrick Henry's militia to come down to seized the powder and ball, but the Committee of Safety did. But we've been denied that Committee of Safety, and we can't find the same problem they had in Western Massachusetts. We can't find people in government that are willing to take the responsibility of government and act as that civil authority to allow us to go to Arizona. We should not be able to be denied the right to go to Arizona and help those people down there protect the borders. So looking at that, my feeling is any militia that wants to go to Arizona to help out is not denied by our history, but they're in a precarious place because they're not recognizing a civil authority. If they were in the act in their community or wherever their militia's from of creating committees of safety to fill in that gap that's missing because the government will not take its responsibility, they fall totally within the heritage and the history that's been handed down to us. Now, I'm not an expert. I don't know that anybody's an expert on committees of safety because we've got to look at old records, see what we can find, and see what was done. But we find committees of safety setting the pay scale of militia when they're in actual service. They were taking responsibility, and if nobody takes responsibility, that cannot be denied. But does that not put an incumbency on the militia to look for a civil authority? Now, we go back to, I think it was 1692 or 1682, Governor Andros was the governor of New England at the time. A militia didn't like Governor Andros. They came under the authority of Governor Andros, so they called the people to create a committee of safety. Once that committee of safety was created, they transferred their obedience to the committee of safety and away from Governor Andros. That committee of safety then directed the militia to arrest and jail Governor Andros, who was held in jail until the king recalled him back to England. He got out of jail to go down and get on the boat. So that is not dissimilar to what's happening in Arizona right now, except remember that militia, since they didn't want to give their obedience to Governor Andros, created a committee of safety, so that there was a civil authority that made the rational decision to direct these people to arrest Andros. So if you're actively pursuing creating a committee of safety and not acting in the capacity of what many statutes call, what is it, a paramilitary organization, then you're totally within our history and by intent, the laws of the United States. If you're not trying to create a committee of safety, I would consider myself a civilian volunteer, not a member of a militia, because the militia could be identified as paramilitary and be in violation of state statutes at that point. But yes, the right of self-defense is fundamental. It's probably the most important right we have, because without that, we have nothing.
So let me get this. If you're actively involved in the Pennsylvania constitutional unorganized citizen militia, you would probably be in a conflict to actually sit on a committee of safety?
Well, George Washington gave up his commission as a delegate to the Continental Congress when they appointed him commander-in-chief. And during the course of the Revolution, some delegates in the earlier Congresses gave up their seats to work in the militia. Some officers in the militia gave up their or in the military, in the army or militia, gave up their position in the military to go as delegates. You could not serve on both sides of the fence.
Right.
You can't be your own boss.
Right.
So, yes, if you're in the militia, you cannot be on the Committee of Safety. But there's a lot of Vietnam veterans out there like myself that are, and somebody said they can't hump 12 miles anymore or something like that on the chat. Yeah, well, you're key element for Committee of Safety. And now, if your Committee of Safety doesn't mean you can't help train the militia, we got a German over here, a Prussian over here to train the army in Valley Forge. If a member of the committee has experience and wants to impart that experience and help train the militia, there's nothing that stops that. He's just not militia. He is Committee of Safety. But you can't wear both hats. That would be in conflict with the whole concept of That's what they give them to cops. Face it, a cop is wearing both hats.
Right.
He's the civil authority, and he's the military authority, and he can shoot you based on his decision to shoot you.
Now, would this also apply for, let's say I'm elected governor. I want to establish these committees, but per se, I could not technically sit on one of these committees because that would be technically being my own boss.
Well, if you were governor, if I was the delegate or a member of the Committee of Safety in, say, Woburn, Massachusetts, and they put together the Provisional Committee, Provisional Congress, and I went up to that Congress, no, I no longer sit on the lower level.
Right.
Now, you're dealing with the circumstances they exist with elected governors now. In a sense, you're a member of every Committee of Safety that's created. You're a member of everything. Red Begman came down back in the late 80s, I think, to speak in Winter Springs, Florida. I invited him down, got the VFW hall there to be the place where the meeting took place. We had a good turnout, and I don't think Red coined this, but he, on a chalkboard, drew a triangle with the point up and said President, Congress, state government, local government, down at the bottom, the people. This is the way we look at government now. This is what we've been taught in school. He drew another triangle with the point down and labeled it the same, the people at the top, the local government, the state government, the Congress, and down at the bottom was the president. That's the actual concept of government that we had 200 years ago. It's the one described by Alex de Tocqueville, the Frenchman that came here in 1832, where the president is the bottom of the stack. He works for everybody above him.
Right.
Now, you as governor would be in the same capacity. You would be working for the people above you, which starts with the citizens, lawful citizens of Pennsylvania, and goes to the town and the state legislature, and then the executive's job is to carry out the will of the people, to carry it out, not to dictate it. But see, the inverted triangle, the top becomes the dictator. When
right.
Invert back to where it's supposed to be, your job is to carry out the will of the people. Now, you have influence with both the legislature and the people by virtue of the being at the bottom and working for everybody to make suggestions to what should be, but if you recognize your relationship with the people properly, you realize that their will is your duty. And that was the concept that was given to us a long time ago.
And that's the concept I put on my website is, as governor, I become the servant of the people. It's my job to serve the people. And I also put it on there that there is no greater power in this country than we, the people. The president is not the most powerful man in this country. He's not even the most powerful man in the world. It's we, the people. He may
carry out our will, and our will is not to sue Jan Brewer in the state of Arizona and make attorneys rich and cost the taxpayers a small fortune to fight this thing.
Now, I've got a question. Equalizer asked a little. I was on the phone with Equalizer. He's the commander of the Ohio Minutemen Militia. And they are actively working on getting them started in every county they're in, which is 74 of the 88 counties, and then having them in every county when they go state, when they are in every county. They're also educating a lot of other militia out there on the safety and having them, and having those that are receptive and, trying to educate them on what the law, what was lawful. Now, he asked a really good question earlier. What happens if there are no committees of safety and we were invaded and the militia was needed? Would the militia be able to act lawfully? I think you addressed that a little bit ago with the fact that they are directly mentioned in the Constitution as being the law. So what would be your take on that? Let's say a major disaster hit tomorrow. Whole country is just devastated.
Well, to me, there's no doubt that the whole reason for the militia is collective self-defense. What good is life if you have none? So defending that life becomes paramount in life. Without it, you have none. With that in mind, fortunately back then they had the structure in place. We've been denied that structure, and we've got government, county, city, and state governments now that reject the concept of militia. Oh, yeah, they're out there. That's the National Guard. Bullshit. We're the first line of defense. We have every right to defend ourselves. So to react in that capacity in an emergency situation, and see, that's how I perceive Arizona. It's not with the urgency of, say, an armed invasion. So it's moderated by the fact that there is time to work, in this case, to try and get that civil authority. But if there were an invasion, it wouldn't be necessary, I don't think, to deal with when your right of self-defense is fundamental. So we've got, a short duration or a duration. If we've got the long duration, we should endeavor to create the proper structure, because that's what the whole thing is based on. If there's an emergency situation where immediate attention is required, respond immediately. And I'm sure that a lot of the people that showed up around Boston were not militia. They just grabbed their bird rifle and went down there because they could shoot some British.
Now, I have a question.
I haven't found evidence of it, but I do believe that to be true.
Yeah. But what about the situation then on our southern border where we are being invaded? In fact, we don't even know who really is all invading us. There's so much speculation about, terrorists of all sorts, whatever. But that truly, we are being invaded. And now it's become the drug cartel who started doing the invading. What is the we don't have a lot of committees of safeties in the states. We certainly don't seem to have any governors willing to step up to the plate and do what's necessary. And we have a federal government that, when you do have one state who's trying to do something, wants to step in and thwart the Constitution. What is the legal authority then of the militia in this instance? If you have no committees of safety, you have no governor willing to do it. You probably already technically answered that, but you have an invasion. And
well, I think the responsibility is incumbent on that militia, as they did with Andros, is to try and create a committee of safety. Now, do they have to stay home until a committee of safety is created? No, but they should have people back home trying to create that committee of safety so that they do conform to the guidelines. It's a gray area. I don't have the right answer. That's my impression, just looking back at what happened with Andros and knowing what happened during the revolution, but knowing also that there were people that were not members of the militia that went to Boston. I mean, that's been pretty clear in some of the writings, because when they talk about this guy wandered in and said, "What can I do?" and they assigned him to a militia that was there that he wasn't from, that was guarding one of the points on the shoreline. So obviously people were coming without authority.
Right.
I think to keep the integrity that is fundamental to the creation of this country, there has to be an effort made to try and create that civil authority to transfer obedience to, because we're taking a stand. If we take a stand on the border, the more stand that is taken on the border, the more we threaten the federal government for failure to do their job. The more they're intimidated by failure to do their job, the more potential arises that things are going to get worse.
Right. Well, it's going to be that way even in Pennsylvania. If you develop committees of safety and you begin to stand up against the federal usurpations that are going on, I mean, they're going to get increasingly more agitated with whatever particular state. So you're eventually going to have to deal with that matter. And so that's going to become a fact of life, is eventually you got to deal with that. Because they're not going to sit down, lay down, and let it happen. Not when they've established the kind of authority base or power base that they think they have now. I mean, where they control the National Guards of all the states, because they've all been federalized. They were federalized, I believe, under George Bush. They're still under that federal power. Many of them are deployed overseas fighting. And we know history that our National Guards are not militia anyways. So we can't count on those guys based on that fact. Unfortunately, a lot of them are, they're all made up of citizens from within their various states. but they've sworn oath and allegiance to that federal entity they belong to, called the National Guard, the U.S. Army, whatever they're going to. So you can't count on that. They're actually maybe the ones called to be used against you. That's my point. So your committees of safety are your really only authority, that you need to really have strong committees of safety. You need to have the legislature and the governor understanding this. And that's my whole understanding now. And I really like the fact that Ohio's moving on this. And I'm hoping Pennsylvania within the next year is going to have a lot of this going on.
Well, I hate dealing with hypotheticals, but I will say, and again, I'm going to refer you to the end of the revolution, beginning of independence, where there were a number of times that Gage was going to send out forces, and then he had second thoughts to stop these militia from closing down courthouses and forcing judges to resign their seats. That was the colonists worked in a hypothetical manner. In talking about that, they had anticipated the British might march. Now, let's look at a hypothetical on the Arizona. Let's suppose that, especially if the bastard president loses in his lawsuit against Jan Brewer, that he decides that he's going to go down and protect the Arizona-Mexico border with National Guard or Blackwater or any other SEIU, ACORN, or anything. But his idea of protection is keeping Americans away from the border instead of Mexicans from crossing the border. That's kind of emulating the same thing that happened in Concord and the same thing that was anticipated. Is it hypothetically possible that those people in Washington would support such an effort under the guise of protecting the militia so they don't get hurt? Those, you know, if we think about those things, right now we've got some circumstances in this country that have grave potential.
Right.
The more prepared we are for them, like having committees of safety or governors of a state. See, once you have a governor of a state, he becomes the authority, and he can direct the militia down there. And so if you're elected, you have the authority to say, all the militia, I recognize you, unless and until your town or county intercedes as the intermediate authority. I'm the civil authority that you have obedience to, and you have my permission to go down to Arizona. In fact, stop by the local National Guard armory and pick up some full automatic rifles. You will take your orders and you know, designate a chain of command and send them on their way to assist. That's exactly what happened around Boston. Tens of thousands of people showed up to keep the British contained in Boston. And there was no Army of the Republic at the time. They were coming from militias. They came under everybody recognized they were in Massachusetts, and so the Massachusetts Provincial Congress designated, can't think of his name right now, Artemus Ward as the leader, and until he was replaced by George Washington, he was actually in charge of that. And the Provincial Congress, which had a chairman, would be the same capacity as the governor, who has the executive authority in the state where the action is, to decide who the responsible authority is. Absent that governor participating, I think that, you know, you would have to look at who seemed to be responsible. And there are at least two organizations working on the southern border that are acting in a responsible capacity. One is the SASB group, and the other one is the Arizona Territorial Militia, which is operating under a different name at this point. I don't know why they chose to disassociate from the militia name, but they operated initially under that, and they're, I think they call themselves Border Narcotic Intelligence Group now, something like that. But so if you were to send troops down, you'd contact the people down in Arizona, decide who you felt that you should assign your troops to, and send them down, and that would be the chain of command that existed.
Mm-hmm.
Because you've established that.
Gary, Smiter is on also with us. Smiter, are you there?
I am.
Hey, Smiter, how are you doing today?
Hey, I'm hanging in there.
All right, listen, Gary, Smiter had a question for you as well.
Yeah, sure. Here's, I'll just give you a little background. Since June, I've been actively recruiting people and basically developing warm bodies. They're all prior military guys with the intent of standing up a militia. And my question really fundamentally is, without a committee of safety, is there another way to be righteously and legally recognized within the state as a militia? Because it doesn't seem like where I live in Washington State that there is any committee of safety developed yet. There are a lot of fringe groups. Of course, naturally you've got the scores of knuckleheads that don't really want to even reflect on the Constitution or, you know, backtracking and restoring things. My concern is, obviously, it takes a lot of time to set up these committees of safety, and obviously we need everybody to do this in every county and every state and every instance. That just may not be realistic for the timeliness. And, like I said,
well, I think that, you know, there's an intent that should be pursued. A committee of safety, you know, I found them as small as 3 members in a committee of safety. So surely you can find 3 people that will say, yes, we're the committee of safety. But what others have done is other militia, they've written to the town or the county and said, we are the militia. We want you to recognize us. And if they get no answer, can I be denied the right of collective self-defense if I receive no answer? I think if they go through those steps and nobody's willing to accept the responsibility of stepping in as the civil authority, that they have every right to collectively defend themselves and to offer their services to others in this union of states to in the same capacity. It's a gray area, but if you've tried to get the obedience, now let's say that the county says, okay, we'll take you. We want you to stand down. Just go home and go to sleep. They're denying you the right at that point. I mean, can they force you? We go back to John Locke. When government gives up its responsibility, you cannot leave government. When you're born into a society, you're bound by that society. And you cannot leave it unless you leave the country and stay gone. However, government can dissolve the bonds by failure to abide by the contract. When they do that, you find yourself in a state of nature. So if the government will not take a responsibility and you're not satisfied with where they're going, I would think that you have every right to create what the government is going to call a paramilitary organization. And by doing so, statutorily, you're outside the law. Lawfully, you're inside the law because that collective right of self-defense. So you're in a gray area. Now, gray areas are kind of interesting. The one that I think of all the time is when I was traveling around the country speaking about Waco, I went armed all the time. I had a pistol with me all the time. Now, what bothers me is if I run into a cop and he said, you don't have a right to have that pistol, and he thinks that I don't have the right, and I know that I do, it can turn into a conflict, an unfortunate one, but I know I'm right. And you as a militia, if your purpose is collective self-preservation, you have a right. But you might find yourself, because of the statute, in conflict with law enforcement. And so you might end up in a gunfight, the one that I always feared because a cop would think that I didn't have a right. So it's kind of a gray area, and I can't answer that. You know, they didn't have the problem that big back then because the communities were closer. They didn't watch television. They didn't go on the Internet. They didn't even make phone calls. They met at a local tavern. They talked about the politics of the day, and we're missing all those things. In fact, as strange as it seems, as much as we like to have you guys here discussing this stuff with us, I think you ought to spend 3 hours a day in your community talking to people, getting them interested in committees of safety, getting them interested in militia, getting them interested in giving our government back. Now, where I live, I just moved here 7 years ago. I spent 5 of that years working. I don't know anybody except the guy to the left of me and the lady across the street. I'm new here. And so I spend a lot of, and I'm getting old, and so I spend a lot of time on the Internet. But the younger people and those that want to change things, I spend my time doing the research, learning about these things to pass it on to you. You need to pass it on to the other people. You need to go out and find some people and bring them in. Bring them into the fold. Educate them. Print out some of the Committee of Safety information. Get it to them and try and get the committees so that we are consistent with the form that was used back then. But if you can't, do you give up the right to collective self-defense? I can't see how that could possibly be true, but you increase the possibility of having that confrontation with law enforcement because they think you're a paramilitary organization, not a militia.
I don't know if I know
that. Does that answer your question?
Well, it gives me some guidance. I don't know if I know what the difference is in that gray area between what one would define as a militia versus paramilitary, because it seems to me that they're one and the same if you want to look at, you know, a punch list of skill sets and abilities and intentions. I mean, the State Patrol, they consider themselves a paramilitary organization.
Yes, and they shouldn't be. They're law enforcement or peace officers, but they have become paramilitary, and that's what that our cops constitutional is all about. But they have a statute in most states. One of our first committee programs, I was sent statutes from Florida and Alabama, I think it was, where they were talking about it's unlawful to be to train as a paramilitary organization. So they've written a statute that gets them to lead the local law enforcement or the state law enforcement to believe that you don't have the collective right of self-defense. Now, that doesn't mean that if you're under the authority of Committee of Safety, they're going to recognize you any more than they did in the past. But in looking at the concept of Committee of Safety, I remember when I went to Vietnam, I was thinking about this on the plane on the way over there. I'm going over to Vietnam, and over there I'm going to be put in a position where I'm going to I may be shooting at and killing people, or maybe shot and killed. But then I could look over my shoulder and look back and say the authority to do so was given by my government, and so they have taken the moral and the legal responsibility for my actions in Vietnam. So I could look back at a civil authority, the United States government, and say they have taken the moral and legal responsibility. Now, if you have a committee of safety, it depends on the state or the law enforcement or the government in that state whether they're going to recognize that you have the civil authority to exist or not. But it will give you a little more comfort in knowing that you've abided by the entire concept of collective self-defense that emanated back from the Magna Carta. So, does it make a big difference? No. I mean, I think you. I have an article up on my blog called Our Security Team. We created this back in 1992 because a number of us in it were writing really nasty things about the government. Now, I haven't stopped. Two of them have been executed since then. But we created a security team for our own protection. Is it illegal? No. We have a right to collective self-defense. We didn't plan on right away taking any offensive actions, though we discussed many times the possibility of doing offensive actions. You might call it proactive for our own defense. The right can't be taken away, but there's a right way and a wrong way to do it. And there's a moral and legal comfort in the right way. Especially if we get our country back, because anybody that acted in a proper capacity. But how do you look at Blackwater? How would you describe them?
Well, I have a personal beef with Blackwater because I took one in the back thanks to those guys when I was in the country. But I know why they changed their name. I mean, they're just a company. I don't know beyond the fact they're a corporation. I would say their individuals have their own personal rights, but a corporation, I mean, doesn't a corporation share the same legal rights as a person?
Well, they do since shortly after the Civil War. Before the Civil War, no, they did not share the same rights. But they are a paramilitary organization. There's no doubt about that. In fact, recently I read an article about a guy that was asked by Blackwater to secure illegal weapons for them to use. You know, they but the government says, okay, they can do it. How can they say that you can't? Because you're protecting your home, your country, your family.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, it would be just as easy for anybody to establish their own company that was, you know, private security or whatever. Obviously, previously Blackwater, now XE, you know, they have some deep pockets and friends are in the State Department, of course, that supports them and a lot more access to things, but it's not uncommon for them to go out into the communities, wherever they may be, locally, and secure hardware, whatever that might be, buying weapons, et cetera. I'm a little bit lost on that, but, you know, that also kind of falls into that gray area, because anybody who forms a militia could easily have a parallel organization there where all the members were part of the company. And does that fall into a gray area? Does that, you know, is that a conflict within the interest? You know, once again, if you don't have committees of safety steering it, you have a board of directors.
Well, I think, you know, when I read the Constitution, until I get to the 14th Amendment, I don't see anything that recognizes. It was after the 14th Amendment that the government recognized the corporations as a person. You'll never see reference to that before. They had the right to sue and be sued, contract, things like that, but they were never recognized as a person. Recent Supreme Court decision says corporations have a right to freedom of speech. Well, wait, corporations don't even have a voice. You know, it's an entity.
My bike can have a voice now, maybe.
If you incorporate it, right. So, you know, it's a bastard. The corporation is a bastard. We are given rights, and that right of self-defense and survival is paramount. Is there any right to a corporation to have a right of existence and survival? No. Well, there is under the Obama administration because they have corporations because they're too big to fail.
Yeah.
But conceptually speaking, I mean, that right cannot be lost. One gives you a little stronger moral foundation, but in either event, you may have to defend yourself against local law enforcement somewhere along the line, which is exactly what happened on April 19, 1775. The law enforcement had red jackets on and cannon, and the militia had rifles on the green. And it became confrontational. Is there anything to say that that won't happen again? I think it happened in Waco, Texas in 1993.
Oh, there's no doubt. I have to put something in here. I agree with your assessment on the corporation status. It doesn't meet the citizen militia status, I don't believe, under the Second Amendment as an individual inalienable right. So I would have a problem on a corporate basis, but that's me. The second thing I have to ask, are we dealing on the committees of safety, are we dealing now in a common law state status in that kind of a realm? Is that what we're dealing with, too?
Well, most states adopted the common laws that existed on July 4, 1776. Florida issues recognized that in writing.
Right.
But common law deals with legal elements. The rights, the fundamental rights, have nothing to do with common law. And common law has been misconstrued, too, because common law used to be a buildup of law, but now statutory law intervenes and creates crimes where crimes should not exist.
Right.
And gives privileges where privileges should not exist, i.e. to corporations. And they call that common law because it's built on precedence. But that precedence is established by statute, and those statutes are in conflict with the whole concept of self-government. They're the government dictating to us.
That's right. That was the answer I was looking for. Mm-hmm.
But I think the phrase you're looking for is what John Locke called the state of nature, and the Founding Fathers referred to the state of nature, too. When government dissolves its bonds with us, we find ourselves in a state of nature. I have considered myself living in a state of nature for the last 17 years. Now, what do you do when you're in a state of nature? You find some other people that are in a state of nature, and you join with them, and you create a committee of safety. We're in a state of nature. There might be some that still recognize that they're English subjects and others that don't believe that they're English subjects anymore. And they joined together in committees of safety. And it wasn't until, actually, July 4, 1776, that bond was broken. So many of the people in militia were considered themselves British subjects. And others considered those bonds were dissolved. So you had the two elements. But that state of nature is what we find ourselves in. And when the Declaration says we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, those aren't given by government. That is the law of nature, the state of nature. Those rights are fundamental. They're given by God. They're our right to exist and survive on this earth. And they've been manifest into a form and defined to some degree in both the Declaration and the Constitution as to what those fundamental rights are, but the Ninth Amendment and the Tenth Amendment do not, or both explain that there are more rights that aren't enumerated in the Constitution. So all those rights are the state of nature rights, and they're the ones that are being taken away by the police, by the state legislatures, and by the federal government daily. We're losing them all the time.
Yeah,
the state of nature
is
the... Go ahead. Go ahead, Smiter.
I was just concurring with you. There's no doubt about that. Anything, and that is not a gray area.
No. Black and white. Did that...
Yeah, that answers my... I had an idea that was the direction it was going to go, but I had to ask it because I wanted to make sure. And that definitely answered my question. And because, you know, when I... Running for the governor of Pennsylvania has been a real challenge in this area because I've had this question asked a lot. And I want to, as governor, restore full constitutional actions that were there at the time of the signing of our Declaration of Independence, at the time of the signing of our Constitution, Pennsylvania's original Constitution, because so much has changed, and it's not been good change. And the statutes, as you explained, I like your explanation, because statute have erased a lot of fundamental rights that we've got that have been eliminated by legislative statute. And that has to be changed. We have to go back and say that has to be changed. And that's why I am absolutely convinced the only way this can be changed is through committees of safety throughout the entire Commonwealth of Pennsylvania in every community that we can possibly do it, because we literally need hundreds of thousands of people involved in these committees of safety all across the state so we carry the weight and authority of the people. And that's go ahead.
If you're elected governor, you have two sources that are more than willing to advise you on what they believe the Constitution says. The first one, the legal one, not the lawful one, but the legal one, is called the state legislature. It's comprised primarily of attorneys who went to law school. And in law school, they learned how to plea bargain, negotiate. They learned statutory law. They learned administrative agency law or agency law.
Right.
Very little did they learn about the Constitution itself. On the other hand, you have people that are questioning government and are looking into and reading and understanding what the founding principles were. Now, you'll have a choice when you get there. Which one are the proper advisors?
Oh, I've already made that decision. It's not the legislatures who are going to make these decisions, but it's going to be the will of the people. It's going to be following the Constitution, because there's a lot of authority that I, as a governor, would have to say, no, we're not doing these things. We're not following what the legislature says. This is not constitutional. But in doing this, I also recognize that if I don't have the backing of the people, I'm vulnerable. I'm out there on a branch all by myself with the state legislature cutting it off.
Well, with your campaign running, well, once you get in a position of power, you're going to be in an interesting place because you have veto power, don't you, in Pennsylvania?
Yes.
Okay, now, a lot of what they're going to try and enact is going to get overridden, by, initially at least, until you prove your power. You're going to be in a delicate political situation where you've got to prove to the legislature that you're on the right track and they're on the wrong track.
Mm-hmm.
That support will come if enough citizens stand up and say, no, the governor's right. You cannot pass this law. And so when you veto a law and it goes back to the legislature for them to override your veto, you need to work the people up and get them outraged and make phone calls to those people. You don't have a choice in who's going to sit on the legislature, but you do have a position of influence where you can get people in the state of Pennsylvania to start thinking differently the next time the elections come around.
Right. That's my stated goal. I've been buying lots of pens for the veto.
Well, as near as I can tell, back in the old days, the pens had to be bought by the president when he signed things, which you're doing. Nowadays, you know, well, the Constitution says that the House and the Senate will be compensated for their service. It doesn't say anything about benefits. And these guys cost us a few million dollars a year apiece in all the extra benefits they get. And then Obama, you know, probably $30 or $40 million a year in extra benefits that he gets, including pizza parties in New York.
Right.
You have to, I don't know how we're going to get it back. It's very tough when you've got people in de facto government, which is there and controls the force. When you're trying to get back to the de jure government, which is the government by right, which is based on the Constitution, it's a tough road to hoe.
Oh yeah, we've got an uphill battle. There's no doubt about it.
If you do get elected, you know, I've got some ideas. And if you listen to the Design for a Plan on Tuesdays, we talked about that, but for the other people, listen to Time for Plan on Tuesdays. As the plan progresses, you'll see what I think is the way that we start bringing state government back into the control of the people, and it's by forcing the government to fear God and the people.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, listen, no. I've got a question real quick. I need to jump in here. We're down to our last 2 minutes. It's impossible to book 2 hours, it seems, on Blog Talk anymore. So we're down to our last 2 minutes, but we have two choices. We can either cut it short now, or we can just let it keep going and we can remain on the archives and people can just download the remainder of this afterwards. Choices up
well,
to you
have,
guys. We have.
I have no problem going on if you feel that there's points that we need to continue discussing.
I think there is. What I would actually like to go into would be something I would like to address right now is what people can do today, right now, to go out there and start forming committees. I think that's an important step right there.
Okay.
Or we can hold that off to the next show. But your choice, either way it goes, doesn't matter to me.
Well, we can get it on this tape, and we can cover it on the next show as well.
Okay.
There's no reason that we can't. You know, if we say it twice, are we going to upset people? Anybody going to be upset?
No,
I don't think so.
I don't think anybody would have added us.
We're on a learning curve. Why be upset?
learning by repetition. We'll just repeat it.
Okay. All right, well, we're down to a minute. So everybody who's listening in right now, the show's going to end soon. The live broadcast will anyways. After we finish, I'll just post it in the chat room at youhavetreadonme.com and let everybody know that it's ready for download. And if you're interested, I would highly recommend you go back and you download the rest of the show and listen to the last part of this. And anybody who wants to is more than welcome to call in. The call-in number is 646-714-4518. Or get with me on Skype. My Skype name is Randy_Mac. Get with me on Skype and I can bring you into the call if you would like to be part of it. So here's your chance to be interactive and get your questions asked.
And if you come on the call, you don't have to talk if you don't want to. You can just listen.
Or you can just come on and listen.
Oh, Randy, will I stay on or am I going to be dropped off?
You're going to be on with me. You're
okay.
On the actual phone line, so you'll stay on with me. So with that being said, everybody who's listening in, good night. I hope you enjoy the show. Come back, get the download. get the rest of the, and download the show later on and finish listening to the last part of this. I think we might end up with another hour on top of what's already been broadcast. So, good night. Join the Committee of Safety mail list today. Bottom link underneath the chat in uftrenemy.com. So join that. And everybody have a good night. We'll see you for the Survival Sunday show tomorrow with Smiter, Emergency Energy. All right, so we're no longer streaming, so let's go back to what we were doing.
Okay. The question was, how do you start a committee of safety? Now, that's rather interesting. I was involved. I started one and was involved in starting another. The first one we started was in Central Florida, and we had a flyer that was pretty popular. I call it the Have You Given Your Consent flyer. And I noticed some politicians using that in this campaign right now. But the question, government is exists at the consent of the people. And this goes back to Locke and the Declaration and the Constitution, the consent or the will of the people, what we've been talking about. And we had 200 or 300 people show up at the library. Unfortunately, like the radio program, we booked it for a period of time, and we ran past that time. Actually, it was booked. And the library closed, and we ended up on the streets. But we formed a committee of safety, and we had 60, 70, 80 people participating out of the 200 or 300, which is probably a good return.
Yeah.
But some things went south from there, and I don't know if it's worth going into them. But I chose not to be a member of the committee of safety. I offered my services as a liaison to the press, but I wasn't planning on staying in Florida at the time, and I also felt that a stigma that had attached itself to me would be detrimental to the committees of safety. There were a number of reasons, personal and otherwise, that because they wanted me to be the chairman, first chairman of the committee of safety. As it was, we got a guy that believed in state citizenship, and he's in prison now. He was one of the Florida common law court people that went to prison. But he felt, after a while, since he was chairman, he started trying to dictate that you could not be a member of the Committee of Safety unless you had to revoke your U.S. citizenship and declare that you were a state citizen. Now, I eventually wrote a letter to the, since I was not a member of the committee, I couldn't even vote or participate in the discussions. But I wrote a letter and delivered to him and all the members of the committee that explained that British subjects were members of the Committee of Safety and people who had entered the state of nature were members of the Committee of Safety. And you don't exclude people because they haven't seen that they're in a state of nature. And that he had no right to change it under the concept of committees of safety. But then around that point, it was getting very weak, and he was still chairman, and the term was 6 months or a year, I don't remember which, but I left Florida at the time, and I understood later that the committee just fell apart. It had a lot of participation at first, and had we not had that one problem arise, which when I got to South Bend, we made clear that it didn't matter if you were a U.S. citizen or a state citizen. But it disbanded, and I don't know how much of the disbanding. This was after April 1995. It was, I guess, in March we set up the Committee of Safety, and I left Orlando shortly after the 19th, probably. So the committee was on the way out along with the militia and everything back then. However, in South Bend, Indiana, there was a lot of enthusiasm for a committee, and being much smaller than Orlando, we had about 60 or 70 people that were interested in it. And it got its momentum up, but then it fell by the wayside as the militias began to decline or went into hiding after April 19th, you know, the BRA building and everything. And, you know, the wind got blown out of the sails or came out of the sails of the entire Patriot Community movement back at that time.
But, Hang on one second. While we're on right now, for the people that we're bringing onto the call, I guess I'm getting some people I'm bringing some people. Some people are requesting to come in. So could you do me a favor for background noise and everything? Unless you're talking, could you mute your microphones?
On Skype, there's a mute button right up by the time tag. Okay. So the committee's, you know, the enthusiasm, the number of people that were disenchanted with government, primarily because of, I'm going to put them in this order because this is the order that really they people became aware of them. Waco and then Ruby Ridge. Ruby Ridge occurred the year before, but most people heard of Waco, and then they started meeting people that knew more about what was happening. They found out about what happened at Ruby Ridge as well. But by the time the Murat building blew up, everything went apart, and the disenchantment with government was on a whole different level than it is now. It was primarily with the police tactics that were implemented in both those events. The economy was fairly good. People had jobs. Their homes weren't being foreclosed hundreds a day around the country or perhaps thousands a day around the country. And so the economic crisis wasn't here as it is now. Now we've got people that in the last 2 years have begun to see that there's a serious problem with the federal government, and they're concerned about doing something. And so there's a whole new crop of people for a whole different reason. In fact, jokingly back then, we decided if the beer's cold, football's on Sunday, and the credit card still works, everything's fine. But realistically, we realized until there was an economic crisis that affected more people than were affected by the outrages at Waco and Ruby Ridge, there were not enough people in this country that were disenchanted with government. The beer was cold, the football game was on a Sunday, and the credit card still worked. The economic crisis that began occurring about 2 years ago is what brought me back from a sabbatical from the Patriot community, let's say, because when it first started happening, I realized, you know, this is what we thought would be the key to things happening. So we've got people, a whole different mindset now that are just enchanted with government. Now, they're instrumental in recognizing that there's something wrong with government, and they're the people that need to come in. Now, back then, I could hike 12 miles with a backpack on. Now I can't. I'm too old for that stuff. But we've got a whole new set of veterans that the government's already identified as potential terrorists in this country. And we've got the Vietnam vets that are experienced, and a lot of them were involved in the anti-war movement for Vietnam. A lot of them were involved in the militia activities of the 90s. These are the people now that could be the core of the committees of safety. So we need to get out and get to these people and get them to understand that a committee of safety cannot be deemed illegal. It's a group of people meeting together to discuss politics and what's good for their community and what's not. The Republicans do it. The Democrats do it. The Kiwanis do it. The Chamber of Commerce does it. It's no different than those organizations, except it has a historical foundation in our history and our heritage. What better place to start? Now, the committees of safety back in before the revolution began, for the most part, they had town meetings in Boston. They didn't have a committee of safety. Sam Adams formed a committee of correspondence in Boston that eventually became the committee of safety when the town meeting was no longer allowed under the order of the governor. But the outlying communities where there's still a potential threat from Indians, where there was a possibility of fire in the village, burning the whole village down if they didn't have night watchmen, the committees of safety would appoint people to, if the town meeting did not, would appoint people to be night watchmen. They would commission the officers for the militia, or the town meeting would. They would have hog reeves to make sure if somebody's hog got out and caused damage, that person made up for the damage caused. There were a lot of activities that were conducted by the committees of safety. When you got further out, say, in the Wyoming Valley in Pennsylvania, where the Indians were always a threat, especially after the French and Indian War, and some of the Indians were still mad over what had happened during the war of Indian invasion. So the watchmen and the militia being active were more necessary. So the elements were there to put these committees together. Well, we've got a government looking out for us now, so there's no need for the committees of safety, I guess. Or maybe there is. If you think that things are going wrong in this country and that we might have to look for that means of collective self-defense, collective caring, collective support for a candidate or for an act on the bill or an opposition to a candidate or an opposition to an act on a bill in the legislature or the federal government, there are any number of things. And suppose there's a natural disaster or for some reason we find ourselves in a quasi-survival mode, that Committee of Safety and the militia collectively can make sure that each one is taken care of. If somebody's injured, they can make sure the family's fed. If any form of survival is necessary, a large group of people working together to secure food and whatever we need for survival, then just a family. If it's just a family, the husband goes in and finds some food, he's leaving the wife and the children unattended. There's a lot of reasons to look at collective security. That's exactly how they looked at it then, and maybe we need to look at ability to work politically in terms of survival, in terms of defense, and all these means. Now, if that's the case, any organization like that, it's a collective head. So the Committee of Safety would have officers. Albany, New York, had 5 to 7 officers all the time. They had many more members of the committee, but they had 5 to 7 officers all the time who carried out the duties. Every 6 months, they changed officers. A lot of people would repeat, but the chairman would never be the same.
You know, Gary, you brought up something a minute ago about how in the 90s, there was always some reason why everything fell apart, and they always felt that people, that nobody was really going to do anything until it affected them, you know, lost their homes, lost their jobs. Last August, there was 94,000 foreclosures in the U.S. That was just in August. And they can't process them all. They said that it will take them probably, you know, it could take them as many as 3 to 4 years to process just what's on the table right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, the banks don't want to hurry it along because they want to keep what they call ghost foreclosures, because if all those foreclosures hit the market, people would be paying $50,000 for a $500,000 home because of the saturation.
Exactly.
Which is a rather interesting aspect of that. But, yeah, interestingly, what happened in the article, the end of the revolution, beginning of independence, what was happening in western Massachusetts is the farmers had gotten in debt, and back then there was little specie circulating, and they couldn't pay their debt off because the crown, when they started taxing, all this money was going to England. So there wasn't any money floating around. There was no provision for paper money, and so everything was barter. And so if you had an obligation, couldn't pay it, the obligation was usually to one of the esquires, one of the gentlemen, one of the richer families. And so there were foreclosures, there was seizure of cattle or livestock to offset debt. And that's when these people in western Massachusetts said, that's enough. We're going to close down the courts. They're not being fair. They're run. They're controlled by the rich people. They're stealing our property. We're not getting fair value for it. We're being put out on the streets. And so they started arming themselves under the auspices of the Committee of Safety, and 10,000, 6,000, 10,000, 26,000 might march to a courthouse when the judges were supposed to take their oath of office and demand that they resign their appointments, and the judges did. So, you know, we're in a very similar, with the economic distress we've got right now, we're in a very similar situation to that occurred back in 1775 in Massachusetts. Now, is it fair to run away from debt? No. Somebody misunderstood me the other day, and on another radio program, after he and I had a conversation, he said, Gary believes that we should absolve all debt. I never said that. But I think what needs to be done is we need to suspend all debt.
Yes, we
but
do.
If you're in a house, you're going to take care of it.
Freeze the interest.
Freeze the interest. Freeze the payments if necessary. And deal with it later. But after we get things back in order where they can't, you know, I learned something interesting about the foreclosure business, 30 years ago. I'd been county surveyor in Orange County, Florida, and then I went into business on myself. And a lot of the surveys had to do with foreclosure, and I'd get to talking to people, including the banks that I'd go out and survey a property for that was being foreclosed. Now, it used to be on a foreclosure, there was what was called a sheriff sale. If you owed $12,000 and the house sold for $20,000, $12,000 went to pay the debt you owed, and you got the $8,000. Well, the laws have changed. Not to our benefit. They changed in the other direction. What I was finding out is these banks were stacking attorney's fees on top of this. They were running the bill up to take the whole $20,000. They would go over the $20,000. So that if the house sold for more than $20,000, they would get every penny. And the person who had invested and had equity in that home would get nothing. It was being stolen by the attorneys and by the banks. So that's the nature and change of foreclosure between what was, what is now. Or I'm not sure when it changed. I've never gone in to look at that, but I've seen the equity gets eaten up on a foreclosure, unlike happened back in the 30s in this country when they were taking farms and homes and everybody moving west during the Depression. People did get the residual. They didn't lose everything. I think that they had to pay the auctioneer a percentage, but he's the one that sold the property, and he had a right to make a living, but it wasn't attorneys stacking loading the bill. So now we're at the point that the attorneys take virtually all equity. You could have a $300,000 home and owe $50,000 on it, and more than likely they can get $200,000, $250,000, maybe even all $300,000 by stacking obligations on that bill. And the longer they hold that, every month an attorney is going to spend 3 or 4 hours looking over your status and everything and adding his $300 an hour to that bill. But they can build it up. So the longer it's sitting in foreclosure, as it goes to foreclosure, the more damaging it's going to become to any equity that you might have in it. Now, a lot
so they've really made it so it's better to go file bankruptcy so you don't end up, you could actually end up owing money even after a foreclosure.
Yes, you can. I did mortgages for a long time. And, in fact, I own 2 mortgage companies and a real estate company. And if you look back in history, you'll find that in Santa Barbara in the 1980s, the city of Santa Barbara almost had to file bankruptcy. People that were buying 900-square-foot starter homes for $300,000, all of a sudden, you know, these homes went up to $400,000, $500,000. Next thing you know, these homes are worth $100,000, but they have $500,000 in debt attached to them. The banks are only able to sell them for $85,000. Guess who owes the remainder?
Right.
You still owe it.
And had you filed bankruptcy earlier, you might have been in.
What's that, Gary?
I lost him.
If you'd filed before the foreclosure, you might have been able to keep out.
Yes, if you file before the foreclosure happens, you can keep, you know, if you file a Chapter 13, you know, I'm not a lawyer, so check with an attorney, check your state laws. But from my experience and all of the clients that I've done mortgages for who had bankruptcies in the past, their homes were included in the bankruptcy and the homes were not foreclosed upon.
Right. They still had an obligation, but the security of the primary residence, I think, was protected.
And the interest rates, if they seemed exorbitant, were brought down to a more respectable rate.
Now, getting back to Committee of Safety, would they have any, if you had Committees of Safety operating in these, especially areas of high foreclosure, would they have any authority or jurisdiction to come to the aid of the people that are in these dire straits?
Well, is the way they're conducting foreclosures now contrary to the Constitution where the people are supreme and the government is to serve the people? my understanding is the way they're operating now is not in the best interest of the people. It's in the best interest of the attorneys and the financial institutions. That being the case, and I would suggest you read that article, End of the Revolution, Beginning of Independence. Can a committee of safety go down and tell the judges to resign because they're foreclosing on homes and stealing the equity that people have developed in those homes and giving it to the bankers and the attorneys? I think that lawfully, not legally, but lawfully, they have every right to do that because the whole concept of government that we had 230 years ago, one that's the corporations. So the authority, it was practiced and will be explained exactly what they did back then. It's shutting courts down. They would not let the courts, obedience to law, if the court rules, you're bound by it.
Right.
Well, if you don't let the court rule, you can't be bound by it. So what if armed militias went out and told the judge, you shall resign. They appointed another one. You shall resign. What effect would that have? What if you went to the local school board that was squandering money with a couple thousand people with rifles and said, no, don't do that. Don't teach evolution in our school. Don't teach that Tommy has two mothers or something like that. If as a people, you went down there, and I've used the phrase, when the government fears God and the people. They don't fear the people. They got the cops to protect them from the people. When the people become outraged and grab their rifles, not intent on using them, but intent on demonstrating their frustration with the system, are things going to change? So, you know, we can look at history. I suggest you read that article.
Now, is this the one I find on which website?
Outpost of Freedom, outpost-of-freedom.com. And at the top, you'll see in an old English lettering a number of recent articles. One of them is The End of the Revolution, The Beginning of Independence. If you go to that page, you will also find a piece.
Hey, Gary, you're cutting
there
out a lot.
There are quotes from the...
You're starting to cut out
there
a lot.
There are quotes in there from the Times. Am I coming in now, Randy?
You're coming in better now.
Okay. There are quotes from the Times. I mean, the book is documented at the end of the book, or the article is documented. At the end of the article, it refers to a book where I got most of the information and the quotations from. Now, when I write articles, I don't just say, I think this is what happened. I find the documents, I refer to them to show what's happening. And because I know there was a plan back then that was able to turn over the British government and push them down to the bottom, and we should be able to do the same thing today, if necessary, to achieve what the Founding Fathers left us as our birthright back then.
Right. Well, that's,
are you
that's,
on the
yeah,
you on the Skype chat? I can post the URL for you. Okay, there's the URL of the article. Now, Stacy, did you have a question?
I just wanted to add, hello, do you hear me?
We hear you loud and clear.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I just wanted to add some information to the part you're talking about the mortgages. Last year, there was actually a case that was decided in the Supreme Court of Kentucky, which can be used by any of us facing foreclosure process. Well, we all know that what they've been doing in the derivatives market is they've been selling the deed to one entity and the note to another. They can no longer, in their corruption, produce both these documents in court because they don't know, have any idea where they're at. So on its face, number one, they won't, unless they can show both documents that you are obligated to pay them, you can pitch. And people are doing it that this, all of the lawyer that know, and they are walking out of court with their home paid off in full because they no longer have the instruments together because of their own greed. Okay, number one. Number two, what the Kentucky Supreme Court decision was about was the fact that 50% of all mortgages in America have been turned over because of that scam to a third party, which is nothing more than an electronic recording agency. So they're using the third party foreclosure action because they know they don't have any right to do it. They can't produce the documents anymore. So the Kentucky Supreme Court, this I believe was last year, said enough. There is no standing for a third party electronic recording agency. I can't give them a purple. I am no longer going to put up with this. They ruled in favor of the homeowner to keep their home because suing in 50% cases has absolutely no legal right to do so. So in other words, if they won the case, the judge can't give it back to an electronic recording agency. But most judges in most states have been doing this. But now we have precedent, because of the Supreme Court case in Kentucky, that if you are one of the 50%, and I'm sorry, I can't remember now the name of the recording agency, but it's the only one used in the United States. If you are one of those 50% and you are facing foreclosure, you need to look up the Supreme Court law and the case in Kentucky and fight it on that basis, which is very easy to do. If you don't fall into that category, then you need to go the route of making them produce both documents. If they can't produce them, they cannot force any action that you are even liable to pay the rest of your mortgage. So, you know, people need to understand. Then on top of all that, there are some attorneys in the Patriot Movement that are also the basis of the fact that our whole mortgage system is totally fraudulent. You get a piece of paper from a bank that they only have to fund 10% of. The rest of it is paper, worthless, nothing. They sell your mortgage the first time only a few days to maybe a week later now. That's how fast they sell it. Let me ask you all one question. You owed them interest until the loan was paid off. They went and sold it. It was paid off in full. You do not legally owe them any interest on that mortgage. So there's a lot of things there. There's a lot of different legalities. There are ways to fight this. The bottom line in the California situation that you were talking about, my oldest brother actually lost a few $100,000 on his house. And people just got to stand up and wake up and realize that they created this intentionally. The rise, the bubble, the collapse, everything was designed so that when people lost their homes, yes, they still owe money. It is a noose around the American people's neck. You know, I used to sell real estate. I used to be a real estate agent many years ago, and I never thought in my lifetime I'd ever say these words. I am not, in the way what I know about it now, I wouldn't even encourage people to buy a home anymore. It's tanking. It's a noose around your neck. You know, I used to say, you know, why, Rand, you're throwing, you know, money down the toilet, literally. But now it's the other way around. At least when I throw money down the toilet, I don't still keep owing. I could move to a different place. You know what I'm saying? So you know, it's really a bad situation, but it was designed to keep a noose around our neck. And it's not no longer a good investment in our country, unfortunately. It used to be the only up in value. And look what it's become, you know. And
well, even
we all know. Go ahead.
I was going to say, even with appreciation of the home values, if you take a $100,000 home, let's say you finance $100,000 on a home, and your home is worth $100,000. Over the next 30 years, if you have a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage at around 7.5%, you're going to end up paying off close to $300,000. So, let's say your home appreciates to $225,000. You're still $75,000 upside down. Where was the investment?
Yeah.
Well, I was recently sent.
What?
Well, I'm not sure how much this has to do with Committee of Safety. I would like to make a comment regarding it. As a surveyor, I saw old deeds, and deeds used to be, I don't remember what they called them. They weren't called deeds, but they were written on a large sheet of paper masked or later. But in my research in history, one thing I found very interesting is it used to require that if I was in breach of contract, the original contract had to be presented by the people that said I was in breach. They had to prove
the
existence of a contract, and I did not have to present mine. That was their obligation. We both have an original. Now, what Lori said is they're electronic now. Now, I had heard of a case in Florida where she had held off the court file because she was saying, I want to see the original contract. Now, I haven't followed that to see what happened, but, you know, that's how the laws have changed. Now, Rory, you're saying that there's precedence.
No.
But that we've got judges now that don't abide by the law, and unfortunately...
Right, I know.
Once you get a ruling, they
well,
go to the appellate court.
Okay, I think you missed part of it. Number one, you're absolutely correct. They have to produce the documents. That part of it has nothing to do with the electronic agency. They flat out can't produce those documents anymore because they've been sold, split up, and sold to different countries. They cannot find the documents. So, yes, they were supposed to present it, and they can't. They flat out can't. So what they're doing is they're using this third party, the electronic agency, to go into court and bring the actual action against the homeowner as a third party. And what this Kentucky judge, or the actual Supreme Court in Kentucky, finally said, you know, decided not to be corrupt and go along with this all this time, and said, you know what, no, we're putting our foot down. You have no legal right for us to give you their house. You're not even to it. You're an electronic recording agency, and we're not going to keep allowing it in the state of Kentucky. Now, somebody in chat had asked, well, what's that got to do with, how is that going to help me in Washington state? You can bring in any, especially a different state's Supreme Court decision, and use it as legal precedent in your case.
Right.
I mean, that's a major thing. We're talking about
Supreme
ruling.
All right, but hang on. Let me jump in here real quick.
Go ahead.
We probably only have about 40 minutes left on the conference call, so let's try and get this back onto the committee aspect, though. But the part I wanted to bring up, though, about the whole economic crash, though, is that it's getting there. We have 95,000 foreclosures back in August. People were at that point now where Gary was talking about. He didn't think people were going to start getting active until they were broke, begging, and starving. Well, it's happening now, so...
Broke, begging, and starving. Now, if they took that Kentucky Supreme Court decision and waved that from the top of their rifle barrel, and there were a couple hundred thousand of, or a couple thousand of them in Washington, and said, you will abide by the law, you will recognize the law, or you will resign, then that's the fear of God from the fear of the people. That's exactly what happened in Western Massachusetts in 1774, before the Lexington and Concord. So enforcement is an interesting word. Force is the operative portion of that. Force is what's used to enforce things. We're having these laws, statutory laws, that don't make sense in many cases, forced down our throat because we acquiesce to the force that they imply by having police departments, sheriff's department, National Guard, Blackwater, Army, everything. If we start enforcing our rights with the threat of force, implied force, the same as they did, then we'll see a response on their part, and they'll realize that we're serious. But as long as we're just waving signs on sticks, nothing's going to change. If you don't believe me, go back and review what happened last year when the Tea Parties were outraged over the health care plan, and all the phone calls were made, and nothing happened. Until we demonstrate that we're serious, nothing's going to change. And I think the Kentucky Supreme Court case would be a good thing to say, we want justice in Washington. Okay, somebody else said something now.
You died there. All right, but basically, you know, the whole concept of the Committee of Safety, though, was to enforce the will of the people and to have the people within your town focused upon the problems of your town. And if a problem arose in the county, for all the committees of safety to come together and focus on the problems of that county, and then on a state level, and then on a national level. And until we actually get committees actively built up all over the place, we're not going to have teeth. We're not going to have any authority. We will have precedents, though. We can go back to our founding fathers for all the precedents we need. But we won't have any teeth or effectiveness. So don't think that, you know, okay, I got three guys in a committee now here in Lawrence, Kansas. There's no other committees around. I haven't done anything to help, you know, spread the word. I just got me and three guys together and nothing's happening. This doesn't work. That's not how it's going to happen. If we do that, nothing will happen. You know, we have to recreate the infrastructure that our founding fathers had for many reasons. One, to enforce the will of the people today. Two, in case anything bad ever happens in an area. Think about Katrina. Look at Katrina. What would have happened with a strong military, with a strong militia presence and a strong Committee of Safety presence? We wouldn't have needed, they would not have needed FEMA.
I just want to be brought up to speed here. I don't mean to interrupt you. I want to be brought up to speed with what's been accomplished so far. I got on the call late, and I'm trying to make sense of everything here.
Accomplished as far as what?
First off, is there any chance of real continuity between the committees today and the committees of yesterday? Because otherwise, as far as authority goes, you know, unless we have real continuity from 1776, we don't have it except in and of ourselves. Secondly, what's the plan from here? You know, what's the outline?
Where do we go?
Where do we go? Yeah. What have we said? Where do we go?
That's easy.
You need to listen on Tuesdays when we do the Time for a Plan program, because we're talking about that aspect of a plan. How do we get back what is owed to us? What is our birthright?
I guess what I'm saying is continuity is extremely important, that you claim some ancestral right to form these committees. We owe some chain. Otherwise, we might as well start from scratch. I mean, and that's what the founders did. And for understanding the point with the committees is to avoid starting from scratch.
Well, the committees of safety then weren't that frequent. They were primarily in the outlying areas where there was a lack of any British influence directly at all. There were either town meetings, which were the same as the Committee of Safety, or committees of safety, depending on how the community looked at themselves. Now, before that, there weren't any. I mean, we go back in English history, and there were committees, but there was a long lull then. There was no continuity from the past. As people moved west and had conflicts with Indians and no other protections, they started reforming the traditional committees of safety. the need for the committees of safety disappeared on ratification of the Articles of Confederation. There was no longer any need for them. But the right of self-government did not go with that. So if we read the First and Second Amendments, the right to redress of grievances, the right to association, the right to keep and bear arms, and the militia, those elements are still identified in the Constitution. Then we go back to the Declaration, where when the government tends towards despotism, the people have a right, they have a duty. Now, where can they get that right and duty without going resorting to those parts of our history, absent the continuity of 200 years, that were fundamental in it then? Or are those rights without teeth? Now, if they have teeth, then we have the right. And if we follow the model that was created in the past, we have created a continuity by using the same means that were used by them to change the government. And in our case, we want to return to the Constitution.
Not only that, but I think that people are really missing the point here as well. There's, you know, the reason for the committees of safety is twofold. One, for the peaceful resolution. Two, for the, you know, the shit hit the fan, so, you know, for the shit hit the fan scenario. A Katrina situation, Arizona being invaded, something, anything. What happens when you have a group of armed individuals who don't answer to any civil authority? What happens when disasters break out and nobody's around to organize things and get stuff put in order and make sure that the rule of law still exists and that we don't end up in some kind of, you know, mob rule anarchic system where everybody is taking what they like from anybody else no matter what they have to say about it? Who's going to make sure the courts still run? That's what we're looking at.
And so the Committee of Safety is then a essentially civilian authority for the civilian militia that exists outside of any formal state structure. It is the people guarding and exercising authority over the toothed people. Is that correct definition there?
Well, if you look at it as the right of collectively defending ourselves, protecting ourselves, looking out for our safety, our security, our homes, and our families, is there anything in law that denies us the right to collectively assert ourselves for the protection of our families? And as Randy pointed out, if the government was doing its job, both the state government and the federal government in Arizona, we wouldn't have these encroachments on the border. It's an invasion. It's not illegal immigration. It's an invasion. When you've got tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people a year crossing a border, it's an invasion. Some of them are armed, some are not. It's an invasion. Let's go back to Katrina. The people in New Orleans relied on the government because the government has become the wazzy, and we'll take care of you from cradle to coffin. So people relied on the government to provide the protection and the safety and security, means of feeding and everything, and protection of property when Katrina came. But the government failed miserably, both the state government, the city, the state government, and the federal government all failed miserably. Now, if you go back and read some articles about what happened the last time a devastating hurricane hit New Orleans, the people didn't rely on government, and they recovered within a couple of years and rebuilt the city. But now with the dependency on government, we've lost the ability to take care of ourselves. Now the Committee of Safety is looking at, if the government is incapable of protecting us, or looking out for us, we can do it on our own. That's a collective right that we manifest through the Committee of Safety. If it's defense, if it's protection, if it's survival, if it's feeding us, sheltering us, regardless of what it is, we have the means to collectively work together to achieve that protection and safety that we have every right to, and the government has proven in those two instances to be unable to cope with.
Well, look what the government did during Katrina, and I'm talking even the state city government. They actually went in and confiscated people's weapons they were going to use to protect themselves from looters, because some of these officers have recently been indicted on those criminal charges.
On murder charges.
Right. So, I'm, what you're discussing here with the committees of safety is absolutely right on target. We have to get past this attitude that the federal government is our supplier, is our savior, is our whatever. It's not. It's our, the federal government is our handcuffs. We're walking around with handcuffs put on by the federal government in almost every aspect of our lives today. And we have to be willing to take these handcuffs off and say no more. And we can't do that unless we establish these committees of safety, establish some authority back at the local level, and begin to enforce that, as the word was used, force that, so that they begin to respect what we're doing. That's not going to happen overnight.
Right. Now, the dependency on the federal government goes to the state and local government as well, as is proven in both Arizona and New Orleans. It's not just the federal government, the state.
Right.
Have become ineffective in providing the service.
You're breaking up again, Gary.
I was raised in California. Is that better? Still breaking up. I was raised in California. When I got back from Vietnam, California had the best roads in the country. Right now it's got the worst roads in the country because all the money that goes in gas taxes, and batteries goes somewhere else. It doesn't go back to the roads. So they're not even looking out for maintaining the roads the way they used to. Did that come through or not?
Yeah, I heard that.
Okay. So we need to look at all levels of government as being deficient, and the plan addresses that on Tuesdays, where we deal with the problems locally first and begin expanding out, like an uncancer killing the cancer. Everywhere it starts spreading out, it starts killing the cancer that's permeated the country. But unless we do something, we sit back and wait for the last stroke. And then we get upset. It's too late.
Well, I'm on dial-up, so I don't get to listen to what you're doing on Tuesdays. I'm going to have to get somebody recorded for me. But are we discussing on Tuesday, or are you discussing on Tuesday your sessions about the proper way to establish these committees so we don't end up with a lot of infighting? Because, I mean, you know, we see that happen a lot within militia groups, a lot of infighting. And we can't afford that in our committees of safety. We have to have some real continuity flowing. I mean, we can't be having a lot of infighting. And
this program you're on now is to deal with committees of safety. The Tuesday program addresses the committee of safety, but it has nothing to do with setting it up. It assumes their existence. It assumes that the people in these particular areas have accepted that they have a right to establish for a effective security committees of safety.
Okay. All right.
So it's talking about what happens if we have the committees. It presumes that they exist, at least in these areas. Now, what do we do from here? Where do we go from here? This program we're on right now, and I'm not sure what frequency we're going to have on this, but this one is intended to assist people in starting committees of safety.
Okay.
Now, you can download those programs if you're on dial-up. I guess you'd have to, you know, go download a program when you're ready to go to bed and go see if you got all downloaded overnight. But
right.
I guess they run about 15 to 20 megabytes, so whatever your rate is, it's going to take a while to download them. I don't know if Randy has thought about possibly putting them on CD available. He's setting up now, I know. Every militia and every committee of safety, when they form, needs to get a book by Joseph Martino called Resistance to Tyranny. And every person with any respect in that organization should be required to read that book.
Yeah, I'm working on. I'm working on getting a price, a deal set up for everybody if they order them off the site. Discounted price over, or cheap, less expensive than what Amazon is charging. So I'm still going to get with Joe on that, but he's been busy for the last couple of days, so I still haven't gotten pricing yet.
Well, that's the one you have on your ad for tonight's show, the book.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Yes, that book is invaluable. I read it, and it goes, it just goes hand in hand with the plan that we're talking about on Tuesday. And it's so comprehensive that it shows the relationship. Why do you need Committee of Safety and Militia? You need all these different aspects. You need communication, logistics. It shows the whole pattern. If you're concerned with the security of your community, have you thought of everything you need? Now, this doesn't go down to the detail thing, you need 3 matches and 7 gallons of gasoline. It talks about it's an overview. He calls it a primer. It's a primer.
Right.
So it has many references to direct you where you can get more detailed information. But it's so necessary that the people that get involved understand that if the need ever arises where it's imperative that you have a committee of safety, not just planning ahead in the eventuality that you need a committee of safety, but if that imperative application of the committee ever exists, that if you've read this book and thought about this and had people thinking about this ahead of time, you're going to be way ahead of the game in making sure that you're protected, that you're addressing every aspect that you need to address to assure the continuity or the continuation of your community.
All right.
I'd like to state something at this point. From understanding everything, there's been a lot of infighting within some of these groups. Guys, it really comes down to get professional, get organized, in a base. Go get involved with local campaigns. If you don't have a freedom politician near you, go run for office yourself. Run for what we had here in L.A. County, Rural Patriots, run for Central Committee of the GOP, and we had a majority there. And what we gave our local patriot community was an invaluable lesson in parliamentary procedure, in how to conduct yourself with the respect of the community. Because, I mean, really, that's essential. Without that, you have nothing. If you cannot command respect from your peers, and that's really my point.
Well, committees of safety would enhance the PCO position because you would be reaching out in the community. They don't have to come to the central committee meeting. They can find out from the committee of safety what's happening there, and you can garner support for that activity. I've got a friend in Washington.
What I'm saying is
going that route. However, he has doubts about whether it is politically possible to change the course the government's on now.
My point wasn't that we're going by doing that. My point that by learning the way that needs to be conducted in a formal professional setting, we learn how to obtain discipline to our meetings within the militia, and, you know, strength through observation, if I might. That was my point. Not that participating in the system will get us where we need to be, but that it will teach us the way to conduct ourselves to be taken seriously by our fellow members of the community.
Well, in the paperwork for the committees of safety, if you go to committee.org, there's a proposed set of bylaws on how the committee would function. People can adopt Robert's Rules of Orders, or Jefferson wrote a set of guidelines. As far as discipline within, that has to achieve by the people that start any organization. The fact that you're going into an existing organization that already has them doesn't mean that a new organization, a committee of safety, can't invoke the same discipline that everybody else does.
Absolutely.
So let's see, we've gone 2.5 hours now. Do we have any more questions dealing with committees of safety now, or should we be... Randy, you awake?
I'm here. I'm just listening to everybody else.
Okay.
If anybody doesn't have any other questions, I mean, you know, this is the time to get these questions out there and start trying to get some ideas about what they really are and stuff. So if you've got questions, let us know. If you're still unsure about what the committees are, go to the forum on UFTreadOnMe. There's a section there called Committees of Safety. It's All the information is in there. Go to committee.org.
They both have the same information, so you can go to either one.
Yeah, you go to either one of them. They both have the same info there. The links at the committee.org site take you to specific pages on committee.org. So,
are any of those sites a specific repository of people attempting to organize? I mean, are
committee.org
sort of database?
Committee.org is wherever is going to be the headquarters for all the committee info. Committees that form up, they can post their information, contact info, so other people that are looking to join a committee can get there. We're setting up, there's a mail system already set up there. So, committee.org.
Are there any guarantees of transparency that people are attempting to establish that a lot of companies that kind of have historically sabotaged militia efforts are, is there any, does committee.org have...
That's how the committees work. You know, it's not a national organization. It's not a state organization. There's no. It's every town itself. You know, if you're in Calgary, let's say you're in Los Angeles, man. There could be 50 different committees in a small area, each for their own little town. So, are they going to get corrupted and infiltrated? Some might, but that's the people.
Resistance to tyranny will explain how to look at people and judge. Now, if you're sending people from the lowest level, that lower level, this guy's not a bad guy. When you take some of the politician dangled in front of you by the Republican or Democratic Party, you don't know what his background is. You don't know if he's a good guy or a bad guy.
I think I lost him.
Yeah, I think we're losing Gary again.
I'm back.
You're back now.
I don't know what happened.
But yeah, that's why we said, Joe Martino wrote an incredible book called Resistance to Tyranny. This was what he did for the military. He was a retired lieutenant colonel. This is the area that he specialized in. You really got to check out that book. I'll have that up on the site here in the next day or two for a discounted price. I just got to wait for Joe to get back to me, but you really have to go. You really should go back and listen to the interview that I did with him recently, and he'll be on this Militia Monday as well, going over part two.
Hmm.
We're going to be talking about a lot of this stuff, and he'll be going into detail in a lot of these areas. So, you know, I mean, but it comes down to, it comes down to everything being local.
How do you
break infiltration? You keep everything local.
You can't infiltrate an open organization. That's my point, is that we need to be open.
Open. No, there's no secrecy here. No, it's going to be as open as you guys make it open. And I would hope that everybody out there would be going out there and taking as many soapboxes as they can and preaching it to everybody on the street.
Let me tell you how open it was in Central Florida, Mike. We had an IRS undercover agent infiltrate the committees of safety. He didn't really infiltrate it, but the subscription form that we used said name, and you filled that out. And right after that, it said, is this your real name, yes or no? He said yes. It was not his real name. That was brought up in court a few years later in a trial in Tampa, Florida, and his testimony was not accepted by the jury because he was recognized as lying and deceitful. But we were open. We were transparent. We had an active participant in the Committee of Safety who was a member of the an IRS undercover agent. We can't keep anybody out, but if they lie on our subscription form, that can be used against them later, as it was in that case. But yes, the Committee of Safety is open to anybody except those bankers, lawyers, and law enforcement officers. Those are the only people that are excluded from it. Does that answer your question as far as openness?